The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly for July the 14th. I'm Alok Jha. Health scares, miracle cures, and pure hocus pocus. We discuss the thorny relationship between science and the media with our special guest, Professor Steve Miller. Also in the podcast,
one route into the passion of discovery in science is through its sense of wonder, its driven, organized curiosity, its the economy and elegance by which one thing could explain many other things.
Award-winning novelist Ian McEwan muses on creativity and how it might differ between artists and scientists. Plus, men's ticking biological clocks, water on the moon, and more bad news for coral reefs. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. After what seems like an eternity, I'm delighted to say that The Guardian science correspondent and Science Weekly's original podfather, James Randerson, is back. James, how are you doing? You look quite well for someone who's got a new baby.
Yeah, new and improved, but with less sleep.
Less sleep? You're looking good for the less sleep. Nell Bose from The Guardian's arts team is also here. You're excited about the interview from Ian McEwan, I'm hoping?
Absolutely. And I'm also wondering why James is looking tanned.
He's been out clearly a lot, sitting in the sunshine the last 4 weeks. That's what he's been doing. Well, enough of the nice weather. Let me introduce our special guest this week, Steve Miller. Steve's from University College London's Department of Science and Technology Studies. Steve, welcome. He's been studying the relationship between scientists and journalists. The stereotype, of course, is that scientists hate the way we journalists cover their stuff. So Steve decided to check up if this was actually true. He polled stem cell researchers and epidemiologists and asked them all about the media work they do. Steve, so what were the results? You polled just over 1,300 scientists about the kind of interactions they've got with the media and what they like and dislike. And it was published in Science, so proper research. Tell us what you found.
Right. Well, thank you very much for the build-up. I would just like to point out that I was part of an international team, so I didn't do this all alone. And I wasn't even the team leader.
Like all the best science.
Well, I mean, I love international collaborations. And the team leader was a guy called Hans-Peter Peters from the Forschungszentrum Jülich in Germany. And so he was the guy who kept us all on cue doing what we should be doing. But it was a good poll. We looked at all of the recent journals. We looked to see who was publishing. This was in Germany, France, UK, Japan, United States. And we picked a sample. And in the UK, we pretty much picked everybody who'd been publishing in epidemiology and stem cell research. And we were really very, very surprised at the results, which is why we thought they made a good science piece. So what we found, something like 39% worldwide had at least interacted once or up to five times. Another 30% had interacted with the media between 5 and 10 times. So that's really a lot. That's 70% of those scientists. And they were basically pretty happy people.
So where does this stereotype come from? You say you were surprised yourself. You must have heard anecdotes of people being misquoted, and it doesn't really bear out. Lots of scientists are quite happy to talk, really.
Yeah, I think it is, I heard about this guy who knew this guy who had a bad experience with the media. And so there's a lot of anecdotes about how bad it was and, aren't the media rubbish the way they cover science? They trivialise it. And then if you actually do a study, if you don't just listen to the anecdotes, you get a very different picture. I mean, what we found was something like 60%, nearly 60% of scientists who had interacted with the media thought it was basically good. It was basically, a pleasant experience.
And so your scare stories and that kind of thing, the things that are distorted and wrong, which anyone would say are wrong, they're disproportionately represented in people's minds, I suppose.
As a journalist, you should know that bad news is good news, as far as journalists are concerned. And so there are a few. I mean, there's, 5-6% of our sample said, no, the experience was mainly bad, we were disappointed with it, or the journalists didn't really take seriously what we were saying, they asked the wrong questions. Yeah, people are just very contradictory. There was always the story that you ask people about scientists who interact, or you ask other scientists about scientists who interacted with the media. And so if you ask scientist A about scientist B, who's got a high media profile, they say, scientist B is just doing this in order to further their career. And then you say to scientist A, well, why don't you interact with the media a bit more then? Oh, no, I couldn't do that. It would damage my career. And you're thinking, so, hang on a second. How does that work?
Steve, do you have any examples of the kinds of stories that might have been badly reported so people get this impression, scientists might have got this impression that there's something wrong? I mean, stem cells is controversial, but I think it's been fairly well reported, actually, considering the politics of it all recently. And I mean, maybe there have been examples that I've missed, but I don't know. Can you think of others that
Okay, well, I would pick up on perhaps two particular examples involving particular newspapers. I mean, I think the Daily Mail's reporting of Wakefield and the scares over the MMR jab, that was particularly poor reporting. But it has to be said that the Mail was really not reporting the science. They were on a bit of a crusade, and they were on a, you know, individual middle-class parents standing up against the nanny state kind of thing, which is where the Mail is coming from.
It's what the Mail does, yeah.
It's what the Mail does, yeah. Government is rubbish. We all know that. Okay. And then you get things like issues that don't really affect people at all. So I did a study a long while ago now of the way that ripples in the cosmic microwave background, the echoes of the Big Bang, were being reported in various newspapers. And it was interesting. I mean, there was a lot of good stuff out there. The Sun, actually, was as good as the International Herald Tribune in terms of reporting the facts. So we shouldn't run away with the idea that it's only the quality press that do a good job and the tabloids do a bad job. But the one that got me was the good old Daily Express. I mean, and you won't mind me knocking your rivals.
Was Princess Diana involved?
No, not on that run.
The weather?
No, no. But it was that, you know, the Big Bang started 300,000 years ago, and you're scratching your head and saying, come on, you guys, haven't
that's
you seen
wrong.
Jurassic Park even, let alone any cosmology?
That's just wrong. I mean, that's a great example, actually, of just being factually wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, the Daily Mail example's actually a bit more pernicious in a way, because it's actually science meets politics and it meets social affairs and all those things. And in that way, there's no actual right way of doing things. They chose a particular way of doing it, which actually angered lots of people, and I think probably alienated a lot of scientists, and which is why it's still having its effects now, which is why, despite various reviews of MMR and so on, you're still getting people sort of denying all this stuff. And I think it's going to happen with climate change probably too. People are going to have interests sort of trying to deny climate change. I think Daily Mail denied it at first, but now it's on its way to proving it that things are true. But there's something interesting about both of those stories, which is that if newspapers are going to cover this stuff and they cover it badly, and a scientist thinks this is really badly covered, what does a scientist do? Do you shut up and say nothing and complain to each other? Or do you try and, what would you say? Would you try and get into that debate and say, look, this debate is happening, so we've got to deal with it. It's not in our terms, but we're going to deal with it somehow.
Yeah, well, I mean, today's newspaper is tomorrow's fish and chip wrapper, and there are plenty of opportunities to get into the debate. Scientists are doing it all the time. I spend part of my time as a planetary scientist, as well as doing this kind of research. And we were rather unhappy some time ago with the way the BBC made this programme on the planets. Did all the research in the UK, nearly only interviewed American planetary scientists. So the community complained. The BBC, they couldn't do anything about the series. It had already gone out, but at least they took note. And after that, they did come to UK scientists and interview them, so that people in the country got the impression that actually, if you're British, you do planetary science or space research or something like that. So just get in there. If you don't like it, do something about it. Don't just whinge.
That's absolutely the best advice. Nell, what do you make of this? Were you surprised also by the results? Do you get people saying to you that, you know, science is badly covered?
Yeah, I was surprised. I wondered if you had a kind of, if you thought any areas of science were badly reported on, particularly, I mean, because you focused on biomedical stuff in the study, but do you personally think that particular areas are more prone to good or bad reporting?
Well, when we set the study up, we thought to ourselves, stem cell researchers, they're right in the front line. You know, if anybody's going to have bad experiences, and particularly because of the ethical issues, it's going to be them. So we did half of the sample pretty much were stem cell researchers, half were epidemiologists, because we thought medical science, but more established, more used to dealing with the media. And there are some differences. By and large, the people in stem cell research are that bit more negative than the people in epidemiology, but not by a lot. It's not like there's a huge contrast between them. So I think it probably would depend on story to story rather than field to field. And again, OK, some papers may have a particular axe to grind.
I'm going to pause all of that there. We're going to continue talking to Steve a bit later, I think. But for some truly riveting science news and analysis, but without the hyperbole, head to guardian.co.uk/science. I'm Alok Jha. You're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, we'll discuss the enigma that was Alan Turing, codebreaker, mathematician and the founder of computer science. First, though, here's Nell and James with a roundup of the rest of the stories making science headlines in the past 7 days. This is your News Jam.
News Jam.
An analysis of moon rocks collected during the Apollo missions has found much higher levels of water than scientists had expected. The study increases the possibility that there are significant deposits of water trapped in the rocks at the moon's poles, which would be invaluable for astronauts setting up a future permanent base.
Almost one-third of coral species that build reefs could be headed for extinction, according to a large study by 39 scientists from 14 different countries. It showed that the double assault of climate change and human exploitation could wipe out 231 species of the atoll-building polyps.
The biological clock ticks for men as well as women. That's according to researchers who have examined the patient records of more than 12,000 couples treated at a fertility clinic in Paris. They found that women whose partners were 35 or older had more miscarriages than those who were with younger men, regardless of their own age. The men's ages also affected pregnancy rates, which were lower in the over 40s.
And finally, a woman has given birth to her own grandchild thanks to fertility doctors who have helped create a baby with three mothers, all from the same family. The child is the product of a groundbreaking new technique to repair DNA damage in a woman's eggs by merging them with eggs from her seven-year-old daughter. Because of complications during an earlier pregnancy, the woman was not able to carry the child herself. But her mother, a 69-year-old woman, acted as a surrogate, and doctors in Los Angeles delivered the child by cesarean section.
Nell and James, thank you both for that. Now then, did anyone spot the fake story in that roundup? That's what I want to know. There were some serious stories in amongst all that, but there was one fake. The stuff about
I just don't believe that stuff about corals.
No. I was going to say, it is about the 20th time we've reported that story. Before we get on to the more serious stuff, did you guess which one was the not serious story, Steve? What did you think?
I thought the giving birth to your granddaughter was a little bit of a yuck.
You see, but it was written so convincingly.
This is
written by the hand of James Randerson. And bear in mind, he writes all sorts of great stories that we all believe every day.
The scary thing about that story is it's in many ways is so similar to the sort of thing that comes out of the European Fertility Conference that was around last week.
It's absolutely true. It's unbelievable. It is crazy. Actually, this is a good example of it. I mean, obviously that story is complete nonsense. But the fertility conferences tend to be very freak showy. And you do get ridiculous stories coming out of them. Exactly, things like grandmothers having their granddaughters and so on. And when scientists sometimes complain at like debates, you know, that media cover things very badly, sometimes you have to think to yourself, hang on, listen, scientist people, you, at your own conferences, you're having these ridiculous stories. What do you expect? Is that a fair thing to say, Steve, or are we just jumping on the rubbish stuff?
No, I mean, I suppose these conferences go out of their way to be a bit freaky because
they get coverage.
And they get the coverage. And also, of course, there's money involved because these fertility treatments can be very expensive. And if you make some pretty big claims, then, OK, you might get dumped on by your colleagues. But at the same time, some people out there are going to hear it. And, I mean, it's really exploitative because there are some very, very desperate people out there who will come running to your door.
And they're exploiting us as well. I feel exploited when we have to write terrible stories.
Anyway,
let's move on to some of the serious stuff. Biological clocks, James, you've just become a father at the old age of 31.
Yes.
Was it the biological clock you were wondering? Are you worried about?
I cheated the biological clock.
Did you? Tell us about that, first of all.
The story is that... you know, conventionally people worry about the biological clock of the female in the partnership. But this research is really trying to tease out where the sort of genetic influence of the woman and her age and the man and his age. And so by having this large sample of over 12,000 couples, they had enough kind of combinations of older men with younger women or younger men with older women, and were able to kind of say, well, actually, whatever the age of the younger of the woman, the man's age does make a difference, and after 35 years of age, things start to drop off.
You
not sound painful.
All right, calm down. but no,
I want to know about the water on the moon.
I was going to bring that up. The water on the moon. Did we not know there was water on the moon, or what was the situation with that?
Well, this was surprising because the conventional wisdom is that the moon is very, very dry. And what the scientists did here was look at rock samples that had been brought back by Apollo 15 and Apollo 17. Apollo 17 was the last time we were on the moon in 1972. And in particular, they were looking at beads of volcanic glass. And by this new technique that wasn't available back in the 70s, They looked at the water content in layers going through from the outside to the inside. And that's important because you don't want to just be interested in the outer layer, because that could be affected by contamination by solar wind, asteroids, etc. And the interesting thing is that the water content in the centre, or more generally of volatiles like hydrogen, was much higher than at the edge, suggesting that it wasn't a contamination issue either by the things I've mentioned or by bringing the samples back to Earth. So that suggests that there was more water in the rocks on the moon when it was formed, and therefore it means that, you know, in volcanic activity that was happening sort of 4 billion years ago, when that water was released, a lot of it would have gone straight out into space, but some of it would have ended up at the poles and possibly could still be there in rocks. I mean, we're not talking about lakes here or anything like that. We're talking about, you know, tiny amounts within the rocks, but still, that might be useful enough. You could extract it, and that might be useful enough for having a base there.
Steve, in your other job as a planetary scientist, though, do you often find that people are still researching on the same bits of little bit of rock 30 years later? This sounds incredible that 30 years after these rocks are coming back, we're still learning things about them.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't look at rocks. I look at atmospheres and magnetospheres and this kind of thing, but people are still going back to the Voyager and Pioneer data, and they're reanalyzing it, and they're reanalyzing it in the light of what's been seen. I mean, one of the fantastic things is that by looking at the comparison between Voyager data and Cassini data, so Voyager was at Saturn in 1980 something. Cassini is at Saturn now. We found out that Saturn's slowing down.
Right.
Not by very much, but it's slowing down. And so looking back at old data sets, it's fantastic the amount you can get out of
it. I bet you the number of facts per dollar for a probe just it goes down and down and down. It's much more worthwhile than
I was thinking about the tax return on the, you know, the tax dollar spend on the Apollo missions. Although it was sort of 4% or something like that of GNP at the time, you know, they're still getting good science out of it now. So, you know, good investment, really.
And a good idea to go back, Steve, to the moon? What do you think? Or just a bit of a vanity project?
Yes, I'm in two minds about it. I mean, it's not my particular interest, but if you talk to some of my colleagues, then they're incredibly enthusiastic. They want to take every opportunity, and the Research Council here in the UK has actually put money aside for moon projects. So I guess that at some point we will be going back to the moon, at least robotically. Whether or not we're going to go back as you know, human beings going up there. The Americans are very gung-ho for this, but there's going to be a new president. Will the new president be as gung-ho as the current one seems to be? And if the Americans go, will the Brits go? Because at the moment, our policy is that we're not involved in any form of human spaceflight. So that would mean a big change in policy and quite a step up in terms of the amount of money we put into space research.
It's the official policy of this podcast to complain about that every time we talk about it. About the fact that we don't have any astronauts. But
well, maybe it'll start Branson and encourage him to do moonshots next.
Well, I hope so. I really hope so. We'll leave all of that stuff there. If you want to post your thoughts on any of this stuff, head to the blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or leave something lucid and illuminating on the Facebook wall. Speaking of getting in touch with us, Keir Mottram emailed science@guardian.co.uk a few months back and gave us some thoughts on our interview with creationist Ken Ham. We read his message out and, as we're wont to do, added a comedy sideswipe. Now, that led to a bit of intervention from The Guardian's readers editor and a light slapping of wrists about how we deal with your excellent letters. So from now on, if you write to us but don't want your thoughts to be read out on air, please indicate not for publication. And Mr. Mottram, we're very sorry for any upset we've caused. Right, let's move on with the show. Now, James, you've launched yourself right back into the deep end this week. There was a lecture at the Royal Geographical Society organised by the Medical Research Council and Creative Pen, a writers' organisation. Tell us what was going on there.
Well, the idea was to try and get at the nature of creativity in both science and the arts. And, you know, is it the same thing? Is it something different? What do they have in common? All that, those kind of questions. And it was a kind of panel debate. It was an interesting discussion, but I kind of felt that the chair didn't really bring everyone together and explain what we were all supposed to be discussing. So for me, you know, the real highlight really was Ian McEwan talking about his thoughts on creativity.
Ian McEwan, there was Ruth Padell, the poet, and Darwin's great-granddaughter.
Indeed, I didn't know that until.
And Sir Aaron Klug, who is a Nobel Prize winner, and Sheena McCormack, HIV researcher at the Medical Research Council. But Ian McEwan was your highlight, you were saying.
That's right. And I spoke to him afterwards about his thoughts on creativity.
You can draw on all the sort of famous apocryphal stories of scientific breakthroughs, and Einstein has one about an object for falling in a window or seeing someone in a lift or Kekule's snake and so on, but a great deal of science, when you look in the back pages of the Letters to Nature, are written by six or seven people. No doubt they've been very excited as a team, but one guy's doing the statistical stuff and someone's drafting it, and some hard done by postdocs done all the donkey work and so on. And so it is not quite like the poet taking a lonely, moody walk in the woods and coming back with something to recollect in tranquility. But there must be. I mean, you know, we're biologically the same thing, and they are fundamentally different forms of investigation, but they must be driven by, at root, something profoundly similar.
And you gave the anecdote about a theory being so beautiful it must be true even though the data were kind of there or thereabouts. Mm. To what extent do you think truth and beauty go together within science?
My own small experience of this is learning at school the calculus, and I thought it was breathtakingly clever and beautiful. I mean, its cleverness and its beauty seemed one, and that you could actually describe a changing system at any given point seemed to me an amazing mental somersault. And it's probably the most difficult thing I've ever got my mind round, because us know-nothing liberal arts folk then go off and there's really nothing that's very difficult to understand in all of literature. Nothing as hard as the calculus, and that's as far as I got, and there we're still in the 18th century, so maybe it was doing that gave me respect. I don't know, it could be that many things are true and very unwieldy, but I like the idea that at least for the outsider, for the layman, one route in is into the passion of discovery in science is through its sense of wonder, its driven, organized curiosity, its sense of the economy and elegance by which one thing could explain many other things.
I think economy is very much the operative word. I mean, one thing that came out in the discussion was that, you know, a theory will be beautiful if lots of the pieces seem to fit together. And so, and if lots of pieces fit together, that means lots of evidence is all pointing in the right direction, and therefore it's true, and therefore that suggests that beauty and truth do go together.
Well, especially if it works across a number of other fields. Clearly, natural selection has a whole range of different sort of specialist inputs that confirm it. So it's no longer in doubt. This is what we want it to be. But whether, you know, if we looked at all the theories that are around, especially I think in theoretical physics, and as Aaron Klug was saying, that it's very unwieldy, particles popping up, generating themselves like kind of amoeba. String theory, then superstring theory, and then its elaborations, had to keep bending and in the effort to accommodate objections. Then we ended up with 10 dimensions, and then 11, for reasons which I'll never know. 11 dimensions just seems to me, 6 of which are enfolded. I don't even really understand that concept at all, how a dimension can be folded. It seems to me profoundly inelegant as an outsider, but I'm told by people who understand the mathematics of string theory that it is exhilaratingly beautiful.
Ian McEwan there talking about string theory, and you won't hear that on many other podcasts. Nell, a quick question to you. The sort of debate going on at this event was simply, is creativity different amongst scientists and artists? What do you think?
I think what you need to do when you're discussing this is define exactly what you mean by creativity. You're talking about the spark of inspiration.
You're taking the philosophical angle to this, aren't you? You just redefine the question.
I just wanted to define the question so we can find an answer.
Oh, God, sorry.
Because then if you talk about the spark of creativity, we're talking about developing ideas, then I think developing ideas clearly varies according to what kind of idea you're developing. But if you're talking about the spark of creativity, then that almost varies from individual to individual rather than from field to field, because the way that people get at ideas or the way that people unpack things that they're thinking about varies enormously.
So it's interesting, actually. You're right. Someone like Stephen Hawking, the way he visualizes the world is very different to the way I do, so that he makes more creative breakthroughs in that particular field. And I think that creativity in that respect is simply his visualization of the world and the things and connections he can make. I'm sure Einstein, I've read, had very sort of strange ways of visualizing things in his head. But I don't know about the difference, really, because between that and, say, an arts thing, because whatever you're trying to do, whether you're a scientist or an artist, if you're doing something genuinely creative and new, all you're doing is doing something that no one's thought of before. And that act is as creative in science as it is in art. And in fact, I would argue scientists are much more creative, actually, because you really do have to think about something that has never existed before.
Oh, but now you're talking about what counts as being creative, whether it's new stuff or old stuff. I'm not saying that
a great artwork is not creative or that it's better or worse than anything. And this is not a question of subjective taste. I'm talking about simply, you know, when someone like Dirac comes up with virtual particles and quantum theory, that really is crazy, crazy stuff that you've got to have a lot of confidence that you're on the right track. Whereas, you know, however crazy your artistic work is, it still exists in the real world and exists in a world that everyone else can kind of understand. I think there's something to be said about that.
Dirac sat over coffee and chatted to people about his ideas, and some people got them and some people didn't. And, you know, there was a sort of a wide dialogue there that meant that he wasn't completely off on his own in a kind of...
For a while, perhaps. You're explaining the new thing in terms of the old, but, you know, this genuinely is completely crazy and out there. For several years, science historians have tried to get a handle on the life and work of Alan Turing, the mathematician and cryptographer who many credit as the father of computer science and artificial intelligence. Whilst working at Bletchley Park during the Second World War, Turing helped devise a series of code-breaking techniques to crack German ciphers, most famously the Enigma code. To this day, Turing remains something of a mystery, but one of the leading experts on his work is Andrew Hodges from Wadham College at Oxford. James spoke to him earlier.
His original work on the topic of computability, which involved this concept of the universal machine, which is now the basis of what computers do, that work was done for the pure abstract mathematics, plus his fascination with the whole nature of the mind and mental operations and how you could describe them in a mathematical way. And that's what led to his work in 1936, which was a great breakthrough both in mathematics and in the philosophy of mind as we see it now. And so nothing to do with commercial exploitation at all. It seems he was always fascinated with the idea that it could be implemented as a universal machine, what we'd now think of as a computer. And then in the late 1930s, he was actually building bits of electrical equipment which would embody logical machinery. Now, it's a pretty extraordinary thing. He actually then was taken on into the British code-breaking establishment in 1938, specifically to give scientific mathematical input into the breaking of the Enigma machine, but was able therefore to bring really special things to bear on that, which very few people in the world had, both a command of logic, but also a real interest in the engineering of actual electrical machinery to do the job.
What do you think his sort of motivation was? Because, I mean, arguably, you know, his contribution was central to winning the war for the Allies. Do you think he was motivated by the puzzle of trying to solve the Enigma code, or was it that he was motivated by, you know, a kind of patriotic desire to help his comrades?
It's very hard to tell. He was certainly, I mean, he was an anti-fascist, and he was on the leftish side as a Cambridge figure, though not one of the Marxist people, but he sort of knew all of that and in fact sponsored a refugee from Germany. He was all into that side of things. But nevertheless, everyone really emphasised to me that he saw, as they all did, all the people who came from that intellectual world, did see a deep fascination in the application of modern scientific mathematical methods to the code breaking. And that's really, it's very hard to judge the balance between those things. I think what's especially remarkable about Alan Turing is that he was able not just to balance those two things, but to use those two things creatively to go on to do something else, something more, which is to use the electronic speeds which came into the later work at Bletchley Park, much, much faster than the electrical machinery he'd have known before, and see that that could be the basis of modern computing.
Andrew Hodges there, who gave a lecture on Alan Turing at Bletchley Park just last week. James, there's a bit of a tragic postscript to the story of Turing.
That's right. In 1952, he was prosecuted for gross indecency because at the time, obviously, homosexuality was an illegal act. And he was given a pretty unpalatable choice, really, between going to prison for a long time or having hormone injections. And he went for the latter, but, you know, it was obviously not a very pleasant experience. And he committed suicide in 1954 by eating a cyanide-laced apple, although there is some controversy over that because his mother always maintained to the end that he hadn't committed suicide and that he was just careless about how he kept his chemicals. And other conspiracy theorists have suggested that, you know, this man who, you know, obviously was privy to some incredibly sensitive state secrets about both the UK and the US. Of course, at this time, all of the activity at Bletchley Park was, you know, completely top secret. The suggestion is that he was a vulnerable figure now because he could be blackmailed, etc., etc. And some people have suggested he was assassinated. But either way, he was treated pretty poorly towards the end of his life.
Steve, Alan Turing was an example of a scientist at a time when scientists were held in massively high esteem. They were responsible for Britain and America winning the war. We're talking about the time when also scientists were creating the nuclear bomb. I mean, it's a very sort of different profession then to now. They didn't really have to justify themselves too much to anyone. What's changed in the last 50 years? Why do scientists, back then no one spoke to the media, I'm assuming.
Well, I mean, some people did. There were some very, very visible scientists. I mean, people like Robert Oppenheimer, who did a series of lectures on the radio. Fred Hoyle, who was, I think, either late 40s or early 50s, voted the most popular person on radio, the famous astronomer Fred Hoyle. So there were some very, very visible scientists. And, you know, you talked about the Cambridge crowd. I mean, people like J.D. Burnell, okay, not at Cambridge, but J.D. Burnell, Marxist scientist, popularizer of science, very visible people.
I suppose it also, back then, it was more about saying how exciting this whole world of science could be, the white heat of technology and all of this. You know, science is going to give us planes, cars that fly, and we're going to not need to eat anything in the future. And the 50s was a great time for this sort of futuristic optimism about science, I mean, despite the nuclear bomb stuff. But does this sort of manifest itself now anymore? How do scientists see science now? Is it more of an economic driver? Is that how people see it now, which is why they feel they should have to justify themselves more, talk to people more?
I think attitudes now are very ambivalent, both from scientists' point of view and from, you know, ordinary citizens' points of view. That there's much less of these kind of the pure science will solve everything, science is the way forward.
People are more sceptical.
People are generally more sceptical. You can see it in surveys. So the European Commission run what they call Eurobarometer surveys, and if you look at how people are going, they're getting more knowledgeable about science. They're saying they're less interested in science than they were, say, 15 years ago. And they are just more ambivalent. And the other thing that you see is that people are, they don't think about science. They think about, well, do we want xenotransplantation? Probably not. Do we want genetic health cures to cure currently incurable diseases? Yes, we'd rather like that. They're very picking and choosing as to what they want.
Let me go back to your study, actually, and on a positive note. The one thing that came out, that jumped out at me at the end was just whatever scientists have to say about coverage and all of that now, they're quite keen to do it. 93% of them said that they want to do it because they want a more positive public attitude towards research. They felt that by talking about it that they would get this. And that's a really encouraging thing to hear, that even if they don't like doing it, even if they feel it's slightly misreported sometimes, that they feel this is a direct correlation between talking to the media and getting more a higher profile for science. And that makes a lot of sense.
Yes. I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that the more people know about science, the more they're going to love it. And there's certainly been quite a lot of studies that show it doesn't work like that at all. But it is encouraging that so many scientists say they want to be involved. They want to be involved with public engagement. One question I always ask, and it's been something that I've been banging on about for ages, so excuse me getting on my hobby horse. There's very, very little in the training of scientific and engineering researchers that equips them for communication with the public or with the media or with politicians or anything like that. And so if we're saying people are eager to do it, quite often they don't feel particularly empowered to do it. And so training researchers so that they feel comfortable talking to the media, they know a bit about how the media works. It's not such a black box for them, so that, you know, just like their science, it might be a black box for journalists, and it's their job to unpick it a little bit. So getting them to understand the media a bit better, I think that's extremely important.
And it works very well once, if you have scientists who've never done it before and you give them a fairly decent experience, or you take them through how a newspaper works or whatever, invariably they come out sort of positive, at least knowing what the pressures are and why things happen in the way they do. But we're going to leave all of that stuff there. We're out of time, and personally speaking, I'm a bit out of breath for this week, discussing such topics as string theory, arts, and you know, this communication of science malarkey. Head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science to find links to all the stories we've discussed and to comment on them. Post a comment there or on the Facebook wall. Thanks to James Randerson, Nell Bowes, and our special guest Steve Miller for all of their words and occasional wisdom. Science Weekly was produced this week by Ben Green and Peter Sale, and we'll let you decide who was responsible for the good bits. I'm Alok Jha. See you next time.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.